title of today's sermon is, Does God Exist? Does God Exist? Everyone here listening to me today knows that God exists, but have you ever had to prove it to a skeptic? And people will be listening to this recording later on. Some will be agnostics, some atheists. Now I have to ask them, have you ever proven that God does not exist? And I invite those people who will be listening later on to stay with me for a little while and hear what I have to say about the existence of God. Many sermons I've heard on the subject of does God exist, they start by reading Bible verses. And I think that's not really necessarily the best way to start. I think the best way to start is to put the Bible aside for a little while and look at other proofs of God's existence. Then once you have satisfied yourself that God exists, at that point, look at how he communicates to humans. So we're not going to read the Bible yet. First, we have to define our terms. The term God. American Heritage Dictionary, the English language, includes a definition of God as this: a being conceived as the perfect, omnipotent, omniscient, originator and ruler of the universe, a principal object of faith and worship in monotheistic religions. He's perfect, he's omnipotent, that means all-powerful, omniscient, knowing everything. He's the originator of the universe, and he's the principal object of faith and worship in monotheistic, that is, religions that worship only one God. That is our definition. That is what we're trying to prove. Does God exist? There are a few ways we can prove that. First of all, look at the origin of the universe. There was a time in the 20th century when the people who study the universe, the cosmologists, thought that maybe what was happening is you have everything in the universe, the matter they call it, which is the atoms that make up the solids, liquids, and gases of the universe. All that stuff at a point, it explodes, it comes out, expands for 10 or 20 billion years, then it all comes crashing in on itself. Then it explodes again, then goes back, and has done that throughout eternity. In the last 20 years or so, they have disproven that. Now they can see that there was something like a, what they call a Big Bang, and all the matter and energy in the universe came out at once 13 billion years ago, and just keeps on going. It'll expand forever. That means the universe had a beginning. Now if you had all this matter, atoms, subatomic particles, whatever, from eternity, it's always existed, and all of a sudden it exploded. Does that really make sense? Do we believe in eternal matter? In other words, matter that has always existed and then suddenly exploded? Do we believe in eternal matter, or should we believe in an eternal God? That's one proof. Here's another proof. Origin of life. Let's define life. American Heritage Dictionary says this: life is the property or quality manifested in functions such as metabolism, growth, response to stimulation, and reproduction by which living organisms are differentiated from dead organisms or from inanimate matter. Notice that life has metabolism. It's a way that an organism makes energy available to itself. And life is something that it will grow. Response to stimulation. For a simple one-celled form of life under the microscope, it might be just detecting something and moving toward it if it seems to be edible, or moving away from it. Or if it's a slightly more advanced life form like me, it's accidentally touching the stove and saying, ouch, you know, response to stimulation. And reproduction, life does reproduce itself. So those are some of the things that are inherent in life. And where did it come from? Well, we know from the theory of biogenesis that life must come from life. This was proven a long time ago. Back in 1668, Francisco Redi, R-E-D-I, did an experiment. He'd been observing that when meat was left in the marketplace much, much too long, it would breed flies or maggots. He did an experiment where he actually isolated the meat. And once he isolated it, it didn't breed flies or maggots anymore. What was happening is flies were not coming and laying their eggs on the meat, and then the eggs hatching and coming out as maggots and eventually morphing into flies. So he proved one of the proofs. Life must come from life. You don't get life from something dead. But in 1953, Stanley Miller performed an experiment that might have made people think that, maybe life can evolve. Let's think about this. He performed an experiment where he took hydrogen, water, methane, and ammonia, he boiled them together, put electric charge through them, and he was able to form amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. You put a tremendous number of amino acids together in the right order, and you get a useful protein. And people thought, that's really something. Maybe life could evolve. But you have to combine them into useful proteins. At that point, it becomes virtually impossible, and you'll see why. Can you produce a useful protein by chance? There was a magazine called Tomorrow's World, put out by an organization that no longer exists. If there are magazines out there by that name now, they're put out by different organizations. April 1971 edition. Consider the possibility of forming a simple protein of 100 amino acids in the right order. There's 20 amino acids to choose from. You got to get them in the right order. Otherwise, it's a useless protein or it won't be useful with other proteins that already happen to be around. So look at the number of possibilities. And the number of possibilities becomes a 1 followed by 130 zeros. That is how many possible combinations you have to make a simple protein of 100 amino acids, having only 20 amino acids to choose from. It's amazing. I've gone through the numbers. It's right. And some may think, well, that's a lot of possibilities, but maybe it could still happen by chance. Well, you start thinking about all the opportunities in the universe in the 13 billion years the universe has been around. And the way you look at that is you say there are a trillion galaxies, approximately, each with approximately 100 billion stars. And let's assume each of those stars has one Earth-like planet. They may or may not, but let's assume that. Then assume the ocean of each of these Earth-like planets is full of only amino acids, nothing else, not just seawater like we would have here. And let's say that you're going to try to link those amino acids together 100 times per second over 13 billion years. What you end up with, number of opportunities now, is a 1 followed by 88 zeros. It looks like a lot of chances to make this protein. But the trouble is, the number of possibilities you had was 1 followed by 130 zeros. So if you divide these numbers together, you see that the chance of ever forming this protein is 1 chance in 1 followed by 42 zeros. The number is extremely small likelihood that you're going to get that protein during the whole time of the universe. This is showing us that you don't get proteins just by chance. There had to be some design, some creator had to make them. Now let's consider the complexity of life. At times, people have said, the virus is a living thing. Sometimes they say it's not. Some question about that. But let's say it is. Maybe it's the simplest form of life. American Heritage Dictionary defines a virus as a submicroscopic pathogen consisting essentially of a core of a single nucleic acid surrounded by a protein coat having the ability to replicate only inside a living cell. Very simple. It's just got a little nucleic acid, people call it DNA, and surrounded by protein, and not just one molecule of protein, many, many countless molecules of protein. So it's extremely complicated, even compared to this simple protein we talked about a minute ago. And then it goes up from there. So this design that we see in life does require a designer. More about the complexity of life. I'm going to read a quote from the book On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. Very famous book, chapter 3. Owing to the struggle for life, any variation, however slight and from whatever cause proceeding, if it be in any degree profitable for an individual of any species in its infinitely complex relations to other organic beings and to external nature, will tend to the preservation of that individual and will generally be inherited by its offspring. The offspring also will thus have a better chance of surviving. For of the many individuals of any species which are periodically born, but a small number can survive. I have called this principle by which each slight variation, if useful, is preserved by the term of natural selection in order to mark its relation to man's power of selection. What he's saying here is that if an organism has some variation, you might even say mutation, that is somewhat favorable, it is going to have a better chance of surviving, and it's going to pass that variation on to its offspring. That is natural selection. The idea is that if something is different about that organism, it's going to have more of a chance to survive than the other organisms around it that don't have that same advantage. But it's got to be a small change. Think of it this way. One of the things you might think of is, well, if an organism evolved with an eye, that would certainly be an advantage because it could see its food, it could see its predators coming after it, have a chance of getting away. But you don't form an eye automatically or in any accidental or way by chance. I think of the last time I was at the optometrist's office, how complicated the human eye is. All these structures inside it, it's just amazing. It didn't happen at once. If you're going to evolve an eye, you would first of all have to have a place on the organism to put it. You need a thinning of the skull in the area where the eye is going to be, right? That'd be the first thing that would have to happen. That is not an advantage for an organism, to have a thin part of its skull. It's going to get doinked in the head, and that's going to be the end of that evolutionary path. You can't have something that complex like an eye evolving, because on the way, there's no advantage to that organism. In fact, there's disadvantages to that organism until you finally get to where you have a functioning eye or a functioning light-sensing organ. Same thing happens with the nose. It's an advantage to have a nose. Think of the deer, of people who go hunting. They have to stay downwind. If they go upwind, the deer smell them, run away. Definitely advantage to have a nose. It's complicated, too. So you'd have to have a thin spot on the skull to have the nose. It's a disadvantage, not an advantage. And think of the ears. Many years ago, I went to an audiologist. I wasn't sure if my hearing was entirely good. Some people would say it's not. By the way, they found they didn't need any help. Say it never will. But the ear is extremely complicated. Again, very, very complicated organ with all the structure that's inside it. It's not going to suddenly appear on an organism. And yet, if it did, the organism would certainly have an advantage. It could hear its enemies, or if it's a predator organism, it could hear its food that it's going to prey upon. No, again, you probably just have a thinning of the skull, which would be a disadvantage, in all likelihood, be an end to an evolutionary path. Now think of birds. People thought at times that they evolved from reptiles. If you're going to have an animal that's going to fly, a bird, first thing you need to do is start thinning out the bones. And actually make them hollow. Birds have hollow bones, a lighter weight, which is needed for flying. If you take a reptile, and for some reason it has hollow bones or a hollow portion of the bone, it is actually more susceptible to injury. And it's not going to have the advantage that we need for natural selection. It's going to end its evolutionary path very quickly. It's not going to function right. Those are the proofs that I have come up with that really show me that we have a creator and a designer, and we call him God. But there's some objections people will have. First of all, we can't see God. We can't see him, he must not exist. We can't really accept that as a very good argument. Think of the wind. You can't see the wind, but you see its effects. You know it exists. Or think of the subatomic particles that scientists, physicists in particular, observe. What they'll do is they'll fire atoms at each other, and during these collisions, subatomic particles form, they go out, and if they're doing this in a cloud chamber, a vapor, they will see the paths of the particles. Maybe they do it in a liquid. It's called a bubble chamber. Again, they see the paths of the particles. They can't see the subatomic particles, but they know they exist because of the effects they cause. Similarly with God. We can't see him, but we know the effects he causes. He creates the universe. We just showed that he designs life, the complexity of life. Here's a second objection. The astronomers can prove that the universe is 13 billion years old. But if you look at the Bible and start tracing back and looking at all the ages of the kings and who begot whom and all that, it looks like it's only 6,000 years. How do you explain that? Now we have to get out the Bible. Genesis chapter 1. Let's read Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is what we've been saying. Verse 2. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. The earth was without form. That word was can also be the word became. Later on in Genesis, it says that Lot's wife became a pillar of salt. She wasn't always a pillar of salt. She became a pillar of salt. You can read that sometime in Genesis 19, I believe. The point here is that there is a gap between verses 1 and 2. God created the heavens and the earth, period. And then the earth became without form and void. Something happened on the earth that then it had to be renewed in the 6 days of creation plus the seventh being the Sabbath. Also, another thought on why the age of the universe is 13 billion years old and not 6,000 as someone reading the Bible might think if they didn't get this point. If the universe was only 6,000 years old, all of the stars that we see and the astronomers see with their telescopes would have to be within a radius of 6,000 light years. A light year is a distance that light travels in a year, about 6 trillion miles. How do you relate to 6 trillion miles? It's getting easier, though, and I'll tell you why. Because our annual expenditures in this country, federal government, is measured in trillions of dollars. Also, our national debt is measured in trillions of dollars. So we're hearing this word trillions a lot. Now we think of it as a light year, 6 trillion miles being a light year. Well, anyway, we don't see that it makes sense for all the stars that we see, remember I talked about a trillion galaxies, 100 billion stars in each, to fit within a radius of 6,000 light years. If they were, there'd be less than one light year between each star on the average. Not what we see. We see much, much greater distance. In fact, the distance to our closest stars, 4 light years. You know, there's some that are much farther away from each other. So that doesn't work either. Back to the point here, objections to the existence of God. The Bible does not contradict the observation by astronomers that the universe is 13 billion years old. Another objection. People ask, why is there suffering on Earth? They look at the natural disasters and the wars, famines, disease, all these things, and say, if there's a God, how can there be suffering like this? Genesis chapter 3, the incident of the two trees in the Garden of Eden helps us understand. Genesis 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was much more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Then the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die, for God knows the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. They were given a test, Adam and Eve, the first people. They were told that there were trees in the garden, but there was just one they should not be eating. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, verse 6, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She gave her husband with her, and he ate. They made the wrong decision. Go on to verse 22. Then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us to know good and evil. And now, lest he put out his hand and take also the tree of life and eat and live forever, therefore the Lord God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. So he drove out the man, he placed cherubim, that's a type of angel, at the east of the Garden of Eden, and a flaming sword was turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. Two most perfect people who had no bad experiences, no bad influence except for Satan the devil, who was the serpent, they couldn't make the right decisions. How could any of us make the right decisions every time? So God has taken almost a hands-off policy toward much of humanity. He will call people, and he's called, you know, called the nation of Israel. He worked with them. He will call people to have a relationship with him. But the rest, this is helping us understand that he's just taking a hands-off policy until a time when he can call everybody. What we're seeing in the Bible here, that he drove out the man and placed an angel to guard the way to the tree of life. We have this in the Bible, and we see it all around us in the world. How there's so many things that happen, and God chooses not to intervene for whatever reason, whether it's for someone who has no relationship with him, or for those of us who do have a relationship with him, he doesn't do everything for us. And someday we'll understand why certain prayers aren't answered. Those are some of the objectives and the answers. If we were to summarize what we've seen today, we realize that to prove the existence of God, you first of all consider the origin of the universe. We believe in eternal matter, or do we believe in an eternal God? Look at the origin of life. Think of the likelihood of even a simple protein being formed, much less something complicated, because then we get into the complex design of life. We have the complex design that requires a designer. It didn't happen by chance. It happened because of a God that originated it, as was in the definition. Now, for people who are listening to this recording, they may say, well, I still won't admit there's a God. And I'd say to them, is it because you're afraid that God might expect something of you? And God does expect things of us. What I would say is for people to be honest and admit the existence of God and maybe just say, I choose not to have a relationship with God right now. People can do that. It's within their rights to say, yes, I do believe God exists, but I choose not to have a relationship at this time. But let's at least be honest about the whole thing. There's going to be a time in the future when everyone will be called to a relationship with God. And we look forward very much to that time.